It is showtime for something that I didn't think would actually ever be on the horizon for events on this channel. Good evening, everybody. This is going to be a good one. We're going to have a debate between Alan Dershowitz and Robert Barnes, primarily on the question of forced vaccinations. For those of you who may not know, a while back, relatively recently, Alan Dershowitz was on a show. It's Jason Goodman's show. I think it's called Crowdsource the Truth, but I'm not sure which version of the show it was on, where Alan said something in my joke is in hyperbolic and hyperdemic manner that in his view of the interpretation of the law, it could be constitutional to forcefully vaccinate an individual. And I think the terms he used was plunge a needle into their arm. The government can take you away and do it, and it would be constitutional. A lot of people took issue with that. And the particular clip was all over the place. I'd say it went viral. And people took issue with Alan's position on this or Alan's interpretation of what the state of the law would be if SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, ever adjudicated on the issue. So Alan had since done a debate with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on a YouTube channel called Valuetainment, I believe. Interesting to watch. And for those of you who haven't watched it, good, because this will be a lot fresher. It's an interesting discussion, and it's a question that is now coming to the fore, if not more concretely, at the very least, much more realistically, hypothetically, given what's going on in the world these days, the pandemic, the vaccination that has been pushed through at warp speed and is now being administered. And the question might be, and it might come to be asked to the courts, for people who don't necessarily want to take the vaccine, can the courts require it? So this is a unique sort of, this is going to be a unique debate, and Robert is running late, and I hope he's not run into issues. It's a unique discussion. We're going to have the debate. I'm not setting any hard time limits for anything. We're going to let them go at it. I'm going to guide a bit of the conversation. If anybody talks over anybody to an excessive point, I have the power of the mute button. But when I say this is unique, it's unique in that I'm not bringing up any super chats tonight. And it's not to be disrespectful or it's not to be piggish. It's because I don't want to distract from the discussion. It would invariably distract from the discussion. This is not sort of the one-on-one that I have with Robert where we're accustomed to it. I don't want to interfere with the ebb and flow of the discussion. So no super chats are coming up. No comments are coming up. And if there's time at the end, we'll do a Q&A and I'm going to take some pictures of the, you know, some good questions if we can ask them at the end of the discussion. Okay. With that said, no legal advice in all of this. Everybody knows the basic rules. Keep the comments civil. For anyone who saw my vlog today, the hard, you know, comment removal is overt threats. Everyone on this channel is very much a defender of freedom of speech. But be respectful, especially to the channel, to keep it. If you can't keep it civil, keep it legal. Now, with that said, Robert's here. Alan is here. I'm going to bring them in one by one. Let's bring in Alan first. Alan, it's good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm enjoying this podcast. I'm enjoying my own podcast, The Dersh Show, where I discuss this issue all the time. And I discuss the issue of censorship. So this is a debate. But if you want to continue the debate, watch me on The Dersh Show.
And just so you know, everybody out there watching, Alan's got a YouTube channel, got a podcast, The Dersh Show, and there's no shortage of thorny constitutional legal questions, right, and more coming up by the day. Now, bringing in Robert. Robert, how you doing?
Good, good.
Now, I'm going to just tinker with this for 1 second. That is definitely not the angle we want. Let me remove myself back in. I want to work it in a way that is going to be best. That is not good. You know what? We're just going to go. I think we're going to do it this way. That way I can sort of pretend to moderate from the left. Okay. So now let's see where I was going to go with this. I think we're going to kick it off with Alan, because I think Alan has taken what is the most shocking of the positions, at the very least to a great many people, if not in general, at the very least on this channel. And so I'm going to ask the first question to Alan, and then we're going to let Robert respond and retort. But Alan, we've heard your position. The initial way you described it was the government can, under certain circumstances, pull you away, plunge a needle into your arms, forcefully vaccinate you, and it would be constitutional under certain circumstances. Now, I've seen your debate with Robert Kennedy. You have walked that position back, I would say a little bit, and maybe a lot of bit, but it seems that you've walked it back a little bit. As of the current date today, how would you describe not your position personally, but rather your position as relates to the constitutionality of forced vaccinations? Take it away.
Not only have I not walked it back, I haven't walked it back since the 1960s when I started writing about these issues. I taught for years at Harvard Law School issues of law and science, law and medicine. I was called the "and" professor because every course I taught had an "and" in it, including law and baseball. But when it came to law and medicine, my position is very clear and it's very simple. If a vaccine is developed which prevents the spread of a deadly disease to others, then the government can compel you to take it. If the government were to develop a vaccine or a medicine that only prevented you from getting the disease, they couldn't compel you to get it. If there was a medicine that prevented 100% strokes, heart attacks, cancer, of course, we would all take it, but the government couldn't compel you to take it. But to make the hypothetical even extreme, if the government were hypothetically to develop a vaccine that didn't help you, it didn't even cure you, it had no impact on you, but it helped you prevent the spread to other people, the government can compel you not to become a typhoid Mary. Now, it has to A, be effective, B, safe, and C, not violate any constitutionally protected principles you might have or medical risks that you might have. But putting all that aside, yes, the government can't compel you to take it. Fortunately, we're not there. Right now, everybody's lining up to get the vaccine. Right now, the issue is, how can I get this vaccine? I'm now 82 years old. I haven't been able to get the vaccine. I want to get it right away. And of course, we shouldn't mandate the vaccine until everybody who wants the vaccine gets it. Now, if everybody gets it, we still don't have herd immunity, and we still need others to get it in order to protect the rest of the population, I believe this Supreme Court would rule 9-0. If I'm wrong, it would be 8-1 or 7-2, no closer than that, that under these circumstances, a compelled vaccination would be constitutional.
Now, I'm going to ask you just one more follow-up before we get to Robert. You say that it would be constitutional. Now, I'm just going to ask you the obvious question. In virtue of what would it be constitutional to administer a medical treatment to an individual against their will?
Well, for the same reason we allow a draft. You're allowing, we don't have one now, but when I was growing up and when I was 18, if you were 18 years old, even if you hated war and wanted to live, you could be compelled to serve in the army to protect the national interest. There are many things that you can be compelled to do. There are close questions. Can you be compelled to wear seatbelts? That's a close question because seatbelts only protect you from yourself. But can you be compelled to make sure your car has good brakes on it? Yeah, because that affects the lives of other people. It's the principle of John Stuart Mill that goes back, you know, 100 and some odd years. The government shall take no action designed to protect you from yourself, but it may take action designed to protect others from you. Your right to swing your fists ends at the tip of my nose. Your right not to take a vaccine ends at the beginning of my lungs. And if I am endangered by your refusal to take the vaccine, the principles of John Stuart Mill, the principles of the Constitution, the principles of the police power would all permit for the government to take that action as long as it was rational and didn't discriminate and satisfied a whole range of other constitutional limitations. So that's my position.
Robert, what do you have to say?
So, I mean, I think it always comes down to how do we decide and who decides? And there may be more disagreement between us on who decides than on how it's decided. The general principle that a community can protect itself from harm by requiring access to that community be conditioned upon that person not posing a serious imminent risk of severe harm is one that the Constitution clearly enshrines. And I would say that Jacobson should be limited to that premise. I'm not a big fan of the Jacobson decision, in part because of how they decided who decided. Because part of what went into Jacobson, and for those who may be watching who don't know, Jacobson is the primary principal case to deal with compelled vaccines in some context. There was conditioning access to the community punishable by a fine. But that's the sort of core decision. But of course, Jacobson was then used to do the Buck decision, which led to forced sterilizations, and was used, cited as a basis in the Korematsu decision. And I thought that the part of the problem wasn't so much the how as the who. In other words, who do we allow to decide? Who do we defer to? And I generally, reflexively, prefer the individual over the state, prefer the jury over the judge, prefer the legislature over the executive, prefer the elected over the unelected. And and that doesn't mean there isn't a role for the court system. I believe there is, absolutely. But I don't think it's necessarily either the first or final stop. And I think so it comes down to evidentiary standards. Like, from my perspective, what has concerned me is there has been discussion of, one, just deferring and whatever the sort of the public health authorities or what I call the white lab coat world decides, that we have to defer to their decision and we have no role in that. That's one area where I'm not sure that's the professor's position, but that's a position where I disagree with. And we may actually agree on that not being the appropriate protocol. And then the other is what evidentiary I would like. For example, one of my complaints with the Jacobson decision is that the plaintiff in that case wasn't so much contesting the idea. I mean, there was an aspect of the case that went up to the Supreme Court that was contesting the idea of whether the rational basis police power allowed for this to ever be done. But what he was trying at the trial court level was to evidentiary contest on evidentiary grounds whether or not that particular vaccine was, as the professor talks about, safe and effective. And the, like right now, for example, in the COVID vaccine context, well, first I'd say I view the legal standard should be that it needs to be a strict scrutiny analysis. Our mutual friend Giuliani, and the professor may disagree with me on this, our mutual friend Giuliani apparently didn't know what some of those standards were recently in court. But for folks that don't know, strict scrutiny is narrowly tailored to a compelling public interest. So I believe strict scrutiny should apply. So that may be one area of disagreement. Second, and that means a compelling public interest and something narrowly tailored to it. But secondly, that the public health interest should be a substantial risk of severe harm. So my concern, for example, is could the state force a vaccine for the common cold? Could they force a vaccine for the common flu? And there we need to establish clear legal standards that says, okay, you can require it in these set of circumstances, but not these set of circumstances.
Right.
And I think that's where some of the debate lies as well. And then it's who decides.
Yeah.
And I'm for as much individual empowerment as possible and public empowerment as possible. And I have the least trust of the white lab coat crowd to make the final decision as anyone, given the ugly history of that.
So we have very little disagreement. We've narrowed the disagreement very considerably. I agree with you that the decision should be made by the legislature, not by the white coat people. White coat people should testify in front of the legislature, and so should other people. And I don't agree a strict scrutiny test, but I think I would accept the test somewhere between the rational basis and the strict scrutiny. I think there has to be compelling evidence that the risk to the public outweighs the not only risk, but the autonomy of the individual. I wrote an article back in maybe February, but certainly the latest March, right in the beginning of the COVID, which said, trust science, but be skeptical of scientists. And at that point, I mentioned that scientists were saying then, A, don't wear masks. It's no good. B, this is not aerosol transmitted. It's only transmitted by touching. And I said, both of those seem to me, I'm not a scientist, to be absolutely categorically false. That if it were not aerosol, if it were not transmitted by air, we wouldn't be seeing it so quickly communicated. So my instinct says that's not true. Turned out I was right. Scientists in the beginning were wrong. The mask, it turns out, is not 100% effective, but pretty effective. In fact, I walked off the Jason, what's his name, Goodman show and in a huff, and we yelled at each other when I thought he was telling people not to wear masks, and I basically called him a crackpot. So I do think that we have to listen to science. We have to listen to scientists. But ultimately, in a democracy, the legislature decides. In fact, I've been railing against executive authority, governors, presidents. You know, people use the term, it's such a terrible term, that the president of the United States is the commander in chief. The president of the United States is not the commander in chief. Let's be very clear. The president of the United States is the commander in chief over several million people called the United States Army, the United States Air Force, the United States Army, Navy. He is not my commander in chief. He can't tell me to do anything. If the president of the United States tells me to do anything, I can go, no, I don't want to do it. You can't make me do anything. Only the legislature makes the laws. The executive then enforces the laws. And so when governors close down businesses and when governors close down parks, I get nervous about how the impact of that on democracy. We live in a country where the legislature makes the decision. So let's narrow the agreement. So we agree the legislature should make the decision. We agree the standard should be higher than a simple standard of rational connection. We agree that we should elevate personal autonomy over governmental autonomy whenever we can do it. And I think we agree that the government has the power, at least in extreme cases, where we have tested the vaccine and where it's effective and safe, to compel you to do it as a last resort to prevent the spread of others. So I think our arguments are about nuance. I think our arguments about not the extremes, and I think our arguments are about how to calibrate these things. And I suspect that if the two of us were in the legislature, we'd probably vote the same way on most of these issues, but you know, we do have some disagreements.
Well, I'll stop you there for a second, Alan, because when I watched you with Robert, I ultimately did, I get the impression by and large in all of these heated debates, setting aside the extremes, most people will agree on a variation of the middle. It's just a question of finding that gray zone. But I want to pick on a few things that you've said with Robert and again today. The one of which is John Stuart Mill. Your freedom ends at the end of your fist and the tip of my nose. And you know, it's a good phrase that, you know, you've extended it to the inside of your lungs. And then the response, and I don't want anyone taking this as an anti-vaccine response, because it isn't. My kids are vaccinated. I take vaccines. I did ask my doctor why our kids get a chickenpox vaccine, because I don't consider anything to be too serious about getting chickenpox as a kid. I got it. I also got shingles as an adult, but setting that aside, yes, one's freedom ends at the end of their fist and the tip of the other person's nose. But if someone, you, for example, 82 years old, have an especially high fear of, let's not say coronavirus, but the standard flu, when should your fear of something be what guides your behavior and not what dictates the behavior of another?
Well, I think in general, when it's only my life and my health that's at stake, but when the life and health of other people are at stake. I mean, I put it once very, very graphically in an article I wrote saying, every American has the right to inhale cigarettes, but you don't have the right to exhale them in my face. You can destroy your own lungs. I'm not going to stop you from doing it. I'm going to urge you not to do it. I may impose a tax on you to do it because you're paying for hospitalization that costing me a lot of money. You're losing jobs. You're losing productivity. So maybe I'll impose a financial cost on you for taking a risk. The same thing with motorcycles. I wouldn't necessarily compel motorcycle riders to wear helmets, but if they don't wear a helmet, I want to make sure they pay the cost of their risk-taking rather than imposing the cost on us. So, look, I would not compel a vaccine to prevent the common cold. Chickenpox, I'd have to know more about the facts. And the flu, that's a close question. Mostly the flu, I would, of course, take a flu vaccine because of my age. But if I were 25 years old, and I have friends who haven't taken the flu vaccine because they never had the flu. They're very healthy. And the flu is not as easily, you know, it's not as lethal. It's not as deadly. Now, people, the anti-vaxxers will give you these fake statistics showing that more people die of the flu than of coronavirus. And don't believe them. Look at the data. Look at the data very hard. The problem about statistics is you can prove anything by them if you just manipulate and distort them. But again, I think we're coming closer. This is going to end up being a very boring program, David, because you are so good at bringing people together that you are eliminating some of the major differences. And I don't see any major fireworks coming. Oh, maybe we should talk about the impeachment. Maybe we'll disagree more about that. Who knows?
You know, we might get there. I just want to get the hard arguments out before we even get there, but we might. But Robert, I'm going to ask you this. I mean, you've touched on Jacobson. Jacobson is an old decision which led to bad decisions. But where in the precedent of Jacobson, to the extent that it exists today, is there any precedent for forcefully vaccinating or administering any medical procedure to an individual against their will? Is it in Jacobson? And if it's not, where is it?
It's not fully in Jacobson, clearly, because Jacobson just affirmed the ability to the community to exclude someone and punishable by a fine. It's most analogous, arguably, to the mental health context, where you can be involuntarily imprisoned against your will if you present a writ. Now, I have problems with that because it includes
I do too.
To yourself. My view is it can only should only be risk to others, imminent risk to others. But that would be the most analogous context to some degree, quarantine law, but quarantine law isn't really a perfect analogy, but there's principles that are embedded within it that could be analogous or applicable. I don't disagree with the professor that, from a predictive perspective, the courts would be much more in his side of perception of the issues. As a prescriptive matter is where I think they should take a different or have more clarity than our current law does. I believe that there are limited set of factual circumstances whereby your access to the community can be conditioned upon an invasive vaccine. And we agree on that. And it ends up being just what does the evidence say in this particular case? And we agree on that the legislature and the most responsive body to the public, the most little d democratic body, should be the one to decide. Because when the courts have just deferred to the military or medical establishment, going back to the professor's earlier article about trust science, but not scientists. Unfortunately, we do not have a reliable set of decisions from the courts. When the courts deferred to eugenics as an ideology in the 1920s, it birthed Buck. And when they deferred to the military in the world during World War II, it gave us Korematsu.
I agree.
In my view, two of the most horrendous decisions in the history of our jurisprudence.
I agree.
Dred Scott. So I think in the end, so why not to the professor? Why not strict scrutiny? I love strict scrutiny. It's the best standard in my view. What's your take on that?
Well, it's a fair argument. Look, I agree with you that Buck versus Bell, decided, by the way, by an 8-1 Supreme Court with only one justice, a religious Catholic, dissenting with no opinion, but telling people that his Catholic faith wouldn't permit him to sterilize people because of the prohibition of the Catholic Church against restricting the ability to birth. And of course, we later learn that in Buck versus Bell, the person who was sterilized was not mentally retarded, that the three generations of imbeciles referred to by Justice Holmes was more applicable to his brethren and colleagues on the Supreme Court than it was to the people in the family that was sterilized. They turned out to be poor people, maybe ignorant people, but not mentally retarded people. They could conceivably have produced an Einstein or a Mozart if they were permitted to procreate. And of course, the Karamatsu decision is beyond anything. Both have essentially been overruled by the Supreme Court, though never in explicit terms. Karamatsu, however, was cited once by courts to support affirmative action, race-based affirmative action, which I also have questions about. This is complex jurisprudence, and you're absolutely right that a bad decision or even a good decision, Holmes's notion that hard cases make bad law was just a typical Holmes aphorism, which made no sense at all. But sometimes you get good cases make very bad law. And I think that the Jacobson case was an easy case because it involved requiring kids to be sterilized as a condition of going to school and a $5 fine. It was a pretty easy case, and it made some good law, but also some very, very bad law. And I agree with you. When you defer to experts, you basically get caught up in the moment. And as Justice Jackson so well put it in his dissent in Karamatsu, remember, Karamatsu, who were the heroes of Karamatsu? The liberals. Earl Warren was the one who called for it. He was the governor of California. Supreme Court decision was written by Justice Black, confirmed by Justice Douglas, dissented by Justice Jackson, a conservative, who said that, the military decision to confine 110,000 Americans of Japanese descent was an incident. It would end with the emergency. But the decision of the court to affirm that lies around like a loaded weapon, ready to be used by any authority that can come up with a plausible argument. So, you may have persuaded me on this show to move closer to strict scrutiny. Here's my problem. The courts are so blunderbuss in their approach that I think you will agree with me. Whenever the court says that it's rational analysis, that means they will approve it. whenever they say strict scrutiny, that generally means they won't approve it, because almost nobody can pass strict scrutiny, and anybody can pass rational analysis, which is why I prefer a kind of intermediate standard that requires clear and compelling evidence. It's like the difference between proof by a preponderance, which means nothing at all, you know, 50.5%, to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which, if it were taken seriously, would preclude convictions in the vast majority of cases. So I prefer the standard generally of proof by, you know, compelling evidence, which is what's required in certain circumstances. So we're not far away here. You've moved me. You've persuaded me a bit.
Well, so here's my question. I'm just bringing up the banner so everybody knows. I'm looking at your super chats, and there's some good questions that we're going to get to and others that I already had on my list. Alan, and this is to both of you, in fact, because I guess everybody can agree on the perfect hypothetical. If the vaccine is effective, if it's safe, and there's no other overriding compelling issue on an individual basis, then. So you know, it's like saying, yeah, if something works all the time, there's never any downside to it. It does what it's supposed to do and nothing else. And the person, you know, doesn't have whatever, then. You know, maybe except for the most stubborn, for lack of a better word, are going to say, I'll agree with you on that. Or, but these hypotheticals are almost impossible to achieve. And then the question becomes, what level of safety, what level of risk? Because any vaccine runs a risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome or certain things. They run a risk. Now, what level of risk requires the vaccine? In taking this example, assuming the stats, you know, what their 99.97 survival rate, whatever. Mm-hmm. What level of risk for the other would trump the individual's right to make the decision for themselves, given what they might have fears, they might have phobias, they might just have personal preferences. So okay, I guess the question.
Let me answer that question in two ways. Number one, I think we would agree that initially the decision about risk has to be made by the legislature, but ultimately the kind of risk analysis does have to be affirmed by the Supreme Court. And that's where these tests of rational analysis or others come into play. Let me be very clear about one issue that should never, ever excuse taking a vaccine. And that is, I'm hearing feedback. I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. It's not on my end.
Okay. If it doesn't upset you, I can continue to talk over. Let me tell you the one area that should never be allowed to interfere with this, and that is religious objection by Jews or Christians or Muslims. Now, I make exceptions maybe for Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Scientists because they have a long history of being opposed to medical intervention. But any Jew who tells you that it's religiously prohibited to take a vaccine is lying. I am an expert on Jewish law. I understand halachic law. There is absolutely nothing in Jewish law. There is absolutely nothing in Protestant law. There is absolutely nothing in Christian law. There is absolutely nothing in Muslim law that would prohibit taking a vaccine that, A, saves your own life. Remember, the Bible doesn't buy John Stuart Mill's analysis. It does make you take actions that are just against yourself. Remember, one of the first sins in the Bible is onanism, masturbation. So the Bible is not very good on John Stuart Mill. But I challenge any religious leader, any mainstream religious leader, to find me anything in any Bible. So, you know, I think it's like the religious people who wouldn't sell a cake to a gay person. That was a fake religious argument. Why? There's nothing in the New Testament about prohibiting gay marriage. There is a very strict opposition in the New Testament to allowing somebody who's been married once to be divorced and then remarried. And has any Christian ever refused to sell a cake to a divorced person who wanted to be remarried? If you can come up with any case of that, then I'll give you the religious exemption. Well, but Christians and Jews pick and choose among the Bible, and they find the things that they favor on political grounds, and then they rationalize it on phony religious grounds, and then they claim religious exemption. It's a phony, and we should expose it.
Well, one issue with the cake argument, because it's what I learned looking through that decision. It wasn't a question. They didn't refuse to sell a cake. They refused to
make a cake. If they refused to make a cake for a divorced couple, I'd buy it. But when you start making a cape for a divorced couple and not for a gay couple, you're a bigot, because divorce is much more firmly prohibited. Jesus prohibited divorce. Find me anything in the New Testament. I'll find you stuff in the Old Testament, but you won't find me stuff in the New Testament as strongly prohibitive of gay marriage as it is of divorce. So it's a phony argument, but that's a little bit peripheral. But I have to rail against religious phonies who come up with religious justifications or excuses for engaging in political bigotry.
Well, I saw someone else's comment. They said, I don't need to be religious to oppose it. But Robert, I'll ask you the same question. What's the level of efficiency? What's the level of safety? What's the criteria? What if someone says, I don't trust your safety measures, which have only been implemented for 6 months? You know, the smallpox vaccine, I can't think, that's probably not a good example, but some vaccine that's been around for 20 years where we could see the results, I feel safer with that. But I personally refuse to buy into the safety of a vaccine that hasn't been around long enough to have a safety record. So where is the threshold there? And does the threshold just not exist such that the hypothetical is nice, but in reality, it's tough to put into place?
Well, I think there's two components there. I mean, one, going to Professor Dershowitz's position on religious exemption, I don't disagree that people can disingenuously, insincerely say that their exemption is based on religion. I'm just always concerned with who decides whether that's a sincere exception or not. Mm-hmm. Because, there are people who disagreed with Muhammad Ali's position that it was in part because of a religious objection that he could not participate in the draft. But I wasn't sure if I should be the one to tell him that wasn't a sincerely religious. So it's where it comes back to that who decides. The standard for someone to decide that, independent of, we can't just delegate everything to an individual. But my reflexive position is, where there's a choice, I prefer the individual over the government to make that decision.
I agree.
But that's my position on the religious exemption component. I come from a Baptist tradition. So I don't claim to speak for anyone else's religious tradition or even my own. Me and the pastor didn't usually get along anyway. So that's another story for another day. But on the separate question of efficacy, I think that's a big evidentiary question, and particularly in the COVID vaccine context, because that's where I like strict scrutiny, because it makes sure we hold to the tightest standards, that courts don't get loose with those standards, that let's make sure it's actually safe. Let's make sure it's actually effective. I agree with those preconditions that the professor lays out. I just want to make sure that gets enforced.
Okay, I have a question for you, though. I have a question for you. Why don't you apply the same standard to the military? Why don't you require, before they can draft my 25-year-old grandson into the Army, that they say it's safe, that it's effective, that the war is worth fighting? That couldn't even pass the rational analysis test. And yet we draft people for terrible, terrible wars. We make them give up their lives. I mean, look at Vietnam. How many American young men who may have cured cancer, who may have been president of the United States, died in a war that absolutely made no sense at all? And yet we upheld it. I fought against that. I was actually a lawyer bringing lawsuits against the Vietnam War, but I got nowhere.
But Alan,
it's a tough one. I would say personally, I'm all for strict scrutiny applying to drafts. My position has always been, if a war that's worth fighting, will have people volunteer for it. Otherwise, it's just politicians dictating whatever they want, wherever they want. And we've seen an unfortunate and ugly misuse and abuse of that power by our own government.
I agree.
And so it's another example of where I don't trust those people making the decision. We may agree on certain principles and precepts that you can require people to defend the community in times of exigent need, while disagreeing about who it is. We may not disagree, but disagreeing with the past history of how the courts have decided that. In general, I think the courts have deferred way too often to both the medical and military establishments, particularly whenever they use the magic word crisis. They use the magic word crisis, and we see that Constitution kind of disappear for a while.
But I'd love to talk about hypocrisy. That's the coin of my realm, exposing hypocrisy. And listen to the hypocrisy on the draft. On the draft, it's the left who says you need strict scrutiny, we shouldn't be fighting wars. And the right is saying, no, no, no. If somebody says you got to fight a war, you got to fight a war. When it comes to the vaccine, it's exactly the opposite. The left is saying you got to take the vaccine. It doesn't matter. No safety requirements. And the right is saying, no, no, no. You got to show me. Does nobody point out this hypocrisy? Why do we not allow, I wouldn't have the government do anything about it, but there's so much hypocrisy. Nobody passes what I call the shoe on the other foot test.
Yeah, well, the old what's good for the goose is good for the gander, which I learned because I was late to my law school class that day. I was only halfway through the case, didn't get to the end, so didn't realize, but so I remembered it ever since. But increasingly, unfortunately, we have a legal, it's another reason why I increasingly distrust the judiciary to resolve our controversies or disputes, is because we have fewer and fewer people truly committed to the rule of law, in my view, on the left or the right, but particularly it seems like more on the left of late. I mean, I never thought the ACLU would completely abandon a lot of free speech positions like they have in the Trump era.
There are three of us on this show, and we're probably half the people in the country who really have a principled view on the rule of law or on civil liberties. For everybody else, it's free speech for me, but not for thee, due process for me, but not for thee. Look, why did conservatives now so strongly support free speech? Because they're the ones that are being censored. Why did people on the left so strongly support free speech during the McCarthy period? Because they're being censored. I think about Jamie Raskin, my former student, a really good guy, tragically just lost his son. He was a student. I really, really liked him as a student. He's now introduced the resolution to impeach the president for a speech he made. Jamie Raskin's father, I helped represent. He was part of the anti-war movement that was indicted along with Dr. Spock. And the reason he won his case was because of the same First Amendment that Jamie Raskin is now trying to trash in the interest of getting Trump. And so, you know, it's for me, but not for thee. And we need to really create a coalition. And I think your show, my show, helps do that between mainstream liberals and mainstream conservatives, all of whom share a libertarian streak in which we have rights for everybody. And mostly I fight for rights for people I don't agree with. I didn't vote for Donald Trump in 2016. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I don't support most of his policies, but I don't want to see him impeached on a speech that has First Amendment grounds. I don't want to see him,
Alan,
you know, Amendment 25th. We'll get to that. But I've just been pointing out the hypocrisy.
I call it political opportunism because everything has been weaponized, but we'll get there in a second. Two things, Alan. When you bring up the analogy of the draft to justify forced vaccinations, I think you might actually be convincing people the other way around, because I don't consider myself to be anti-vaccine. I thoroughly consider myself to be anti-draft.
Under all circumstances, I mean, if we were invaded by an enemy force and the only way to resist the enemy force was to draft 18 to 30-year-olds into the army, you would be categorically opposed to it, right?
If we were being invaded by an enemy force and the population did not want to oppose that enemy force, contextually, I might ask which enemy force is the enemy force?
No. Let's assume that a lot of people did and volunteered, but then they said, why should our children die if your children are not being subject to the draft? Look, I could buy into something that says you don't have to fight, but you have to give 2 years of your life to not being paid to take over and do the jobs that the people who are sacrificing their lives are doing. You don't get a free pass when our country is facing great crises. So that's the position.
I could agree. I could accept that potential compromise where versus being sent off to Vietnam to fight in the jungle, yeah, you have to take a job and manufacture, maybe. But I think if the argument is going to be the draft is constitutional, so too should forced vaccines, you might actually convince a lot of people who are not anti to be anti, because a lot of people are against the draft.
My job is not try to convince. My job is to make you consistent. And that would at least be a consistent argument. So that's fine.
And now the other question is, for both of you, safety is one of the primary concerns. If safety is going to be a precondition to administering a compelled vaccine, well, do we not think then that all forms of immunity for medical vaccine manufacturers should be eliminated? If you're going to say it's so safe that it's safe for me to compel you to take it, it should be safe enough to strip all medical companies of any form of immunity for manufacturing and administering.
That's an empirical question. It's an empirical question. You have to ask the question whether requiring immunity or exemption from lawsuits is essential to get them to go to warp speed and create the vaccine. That is, would we get the vaccine as quickly as we have it if they had to worry about lawsuits and they had to put everything through not only medical analysis, but legal analysis? So I think there's a balance there. I don't like giving anybody exemption. I don't like Section 230 of the Decency Communications Act. And I don't like an overbroad vaccine exemption. But we have to think about the implications of not having it. Let me give you an example. It may be a stretched example. Some years ago, I was asked for my opinion as to whether or not the usual rule that doctors cannot report anything their clients or patients tell them, or lawyers, but doctors, should be exempt, should be changed so that if a doctor or a hospital suspects that a child may be being abused, they are entitled to report that to the police. And that sounded like a very good idea. Let's eliminate that exemption. Let's let hospitals and doctors report it. The end result was that fewer people who abused their children brought their kids into hospitals. There's no free lunch. And we always make decisions that have some of them known effects, some of them unknown effects. And we have to try our best to think through the implications. So I'm not prepared to answer the question on whether we should exempt vaccine companies and pharmaceuticals. I need more data to understand what the effect of that might be on the production of viable vaccines.
Robert, do you want to feel this one? Because my understanding is that the immunity predates COVID and warp speed by a long shot. And
so there's no doubt.
And the argument is going to be, you're telling someone that they have to sacrifice their own physical autonomy, and you may have, not you, but one may have the best reasons and the most compelling reasons in the world. If safety is one of the preconditions, you want to do it? You'd better damn well make sure that they have the rights and recourses that come along with any sort of potential problem. And if it is so safe that it's the precondition satisfied to administer forcefully, then the company deserves no immunity whatsoever to assure that safety.
Just to add one more thing before we hear from our other distinguished guest, and that is pharmaceutical companies are terrified about juries because all you have to do is make an allegation, and then juries can believe that autism is caused by vaccination. And if they do believe that, it's medically not true as far as we know, but if a jury believes that, they could put a pharmaceutical company out of business. So the fear of juries coming up with enormous verdicts against pharmaceutical, juries don't like big pharma. And so that has to factor into it as well. Look, it's a hard question. I think it's a good thing you've raised it because it's worth debating.
Robert?
Yeah, I mean, my perspective is a couple of things. If it was solely immunity to expedite a vaccine and you have informed consent during the voluntary stage of people taking it, that they know that, by the way, this company is immune if there's anything that's wrong with it, I see that as a different dynamic. I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with, I'm not a fan of immunity in general, not a fan of it. And it goes back to a who decides question. Who do I fear more? Do I fear big pharma more? Do I fear gubernatorial edicts more? Do I fear courts going AWOL more? Do I fear the white lab coat crowd more? Or do I fear juries more? And the reality is I fear all the others before I fear a jury. So that if things are going to go AWOL, it goes to a who decides decision. And I trust juries to make the right decision. And at least if you look at the medical malpractice context, over 80, 85% of the time, juries rule in favor of doctors. They have a hard time judging doctors negatively. Legal malpractice, maybe less so, but that's a different dynamic. But so I think in that context, I mean, same with like, it's my argument for taking away qualified immunity for police officers. The reality is, in my civil rights experience, at least, and the professor can speak to his own, it's generally hard to sue a cop. Now, maybe that's changing these days, but most juries are very deferential to the police. I've never seen anybody lie more on the stand, frankly, than for police officers.
It's called test-lying. I helped to develop that term, and I wrote about it since, I think in my first book in 1982, I coined the term test-lying by police.
And I know that the last time Robert said that, you got chewed out in the comment section. I got emails from police officers saying they found it disrespectful that cops are some of the,
I don't blame the cops. Let me be very clear. I don't blame the cops. I blame the prosecutors and the judges. The prosecutors put the cops up to it. They tolerate it. They know when lying has occurred. And the judges put on their little blinders and they say, no, you said he dropped the drugs while he was running away. Who am I to disbelieve you? And so it's the judges and the prosecutors, and the police are as much victims of this often as are the defendants themselves.
In fact, I mean, I've had cases where when a law enforcement officer was honest, they got demoted or dismissed or suffered consequences. Whereas when they lied, they often got promoted. So there's a disincentive system built in institutionally. And we have too many former prosecutors on the bench. I mean, that's a whole nother thing. It'd be nice if we had diverse life experience in our judiciary. It's another reason.
You know what we're having for the first time in American history, at least the first time since Abraham Lincoln, a president of the United States who started his career not as a prosecutor, but as a defense attorney. Biden was a public defender for, 12 hours, a very short period of time before he went into politics, but he started his life as a defense attorney. And I'm really looking forward to him being a little bit more understanding, at least of the role of defense attorneys. You should read my emails whenever I defend somebody who people don't like. And believe me, with O.J. Simpson and Klaus von Bülow and Patricia, you know, you name it, Michael Milken, Mike Tyson, and now, of course, Donald Trump. You can just imagine my emails and how much I'm hated by people who don't understand the role of defense counsel.
And anybody who doesn't understand that, I invite you to go back and watch my last interview with Alan, because it was a passionate defense of defending the prima facie indefensible. But now someone asked a good question in the comment section, and I know the answer is going to be a legislative answer. How can you talk about compelled forced vaccinations while simultaneously decriminalizing knowingly exposing someone to HIV? Or not decriminalizing, but reducing the criminal sanctions applicable to knowingly exposing someone else to HIV.
I wouldn't be in favor of that. I think if you knowingly expose somebody to HIV, you should be responsible. And if you do it deliberately and willfully, you should be criminally responsible. I think the same thing is true with COVID. If you take your mask off and cough in somebody's face and say, here, I'm giving you COVID, that conceivably should be a crime. And I think there have been some people prosecuted in the HIV context. So I'm not aware of, and I would oppose any legislative action that would completely immunize people from deliberately inflicting somebody with a disease.
I think it was in California. They reduced it from a felony to a misdemeanor to knowingly expose someone to HIV. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think I am.
Yeah, well, and my thought on that all the way through was, to me, criminal assault statutes were sufficient to cover that. And by getting into the realm of doing so, it was going to create a lot of conflicts. In other words, because now it became a specific statute, so it was going to govern the relevant conduct. And now you could argue that assault couldn't cover it because there was a specific separate statute to cover it. And it was inevitably going to go down the path that I think it unfortunately took. But I also, to the safe and effective issue, the whole core of the idea that there can be constitutionally valid compelled vaccines is to prevent, as the professor notes, transmissibility. But we have the World Health Organization last week saying that this vaccine won't have any effect on transmissibility. I assume he would agree that if that turns out to be the evidentiary case, just an if, that then we could not coerce vaccines in the COVID context.
I think we're going to see, again, a nuanced conclusion that it has a much lower effect on transmissibility, direct effect on transmissibility, but it has a direct effect, an indirect effect on transmissibility, and it'll be complicated. And I agree with you. If in the end it turns out it has no effect or little effect, the case for compelled vaccine is great. Look, the implications are grave. Look, remember what Castro, the great, you know, who people on the left love, Fidel Castro. When AIDS broke out there, he just took gay people and locked them up in concentration camps and said, that's the way we're going to stop the spread of AIDS. And he did. I mean, the one thing about Castro is he was a pretty effective dictator. Like Mussolini, he made the trains run on time. And, you know, if you want to stop the spread of illnesses, there are ways of doing it, ranging from execution to deportation to, you know, locking people up. As you said earlier, and I said myself, there's always the option. If you want to live in a bubble, I'm living in a bubble now. I'm living with my family in an isolated area. We don't see anybody. I go for walks every day. I haven't been to a store. I don't think I have to. I'm going to take the vaccine when it's made available, but I don't have to take it because I'm not subjecting anybody to a transmission. But if you want to live in the real world, if you want to go to school, if you want to get on airplanes, now, tonight, they just announced that there's going to be a no-fly rule unless you can show that you've been vaccinated or have the antibodies. You're not going to be allowed on an airplane. And that also raises issues because airplane travel is, you know, essential to life in America. But that seems to me a rational approach.
That actually is one of the other issues, is we're talking about compelled vaccination by government. All of these questions are probably going to be asked in the exact same way, but with just de facto forced vaccinations. If you want to leave your house, if you want to travel, get on a train. And incidentally, this answers also Chris Reeves' super chat about whether or not, you know, if someone has the antibodies, obviously that might be one of the legislative exceptions.
let me tell you another thing that's coming up now that I've read about. And that is, let's assume that, forget about the government, that employers, large employers, Amazon, you know, anybody, says, you don't have to take the vaccine, it's up to you. But if you don't take the vaccine, you can't work here. You can't come to work. And we're tired of having people work from home. So taking the vaccine is a condition of employment. Okay, that's abstract issue one. But here's the way the issue becomes interesting. A much higher percentage of people of color and minorities, apparently, at least according to current data, are refusing to take the vaccine. So does a mandate like that by an employer constitute de facto racial discrimination? If the effect is to fire more black people than white people, because more white people are willing to take the vaccine, would that run afoul of some of the new approaches to racial discrimination that don't look at intent, but look at effect? So, you know, again, we could teach the three of us, we're all lawyers, we could teach a law school seminar on all of these issues that grow out of the COVID vaccine.
Robert. Yeah, my own instincts on a lot of this, especially now that it's overlapping in the political context, is to have a four-cause limit. I've always been in favor of state laws that have four-cause limitations on firing employees if you're an employer of a certain size or scale. Mm-hmm. Just because inevitably it's going to be a power. I mean, it was my old debate with my law professor on it, which was, you know, it goes back to power. Who decides? The argument was, well, no employer would make an economically bad decision to fire someone. And my argument was people in the name of power will do a lot of dumb stuff.
Of course.
And so let me
give you an example of that. Perfect example. I have to brag a little, but it's a perfect example. I was first in my class at Yale Law School, which is the most elite and hardest law school in the country to get into. I was editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. I had been selected to be a Supreme Court law clerk, and I was turned down by 32 out of 32 Wall Street firms. Were they making an economic decision? Of course not. I would have been the smartest guy in the law firm. I would have brought them success in court. Increasingly, there were Jewish judges on the bench. They just sacrificed economic success to pure bigotry. They just didn't want Eastern European Jews in their law firms. And finally, we brought lawsuits, and I won one of the most important lawsuits, not on my own behalf, but on behalf of an Italian American who sued Cravath, Swain, and Moore because they wouldn't promote him because they didn't take Catholics. They would take a Catholic if you were a British Catholic. But if your name ended in a vowel and it was Italian, or it was Irish, or it started in a vowel and it was Irish, if you were O'Brien or Antonelli, you weren't getting a job in Cravath. And those were not made on economic basis. Those were made on pure bigoted basis, not hiring women. Women are brilliant. You know, as soon as I started teaching at Harvard Law School, I started hiring mostly women to work with me as research assistants after law school, because these were the people who couldn't get jobs. These were the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs. They were available to me to be hired. The guy who was the equivalent of them was being gobbled up by all the Wall Street firms. So, you know, I was smart. I hired all the people that the Wall Street firms wouldn't hire. I made a wise economic decision and they made unwise economic decisions. So I agree with you completely.
Well, this might be the, let me take the banner off. This might be the perfect segue. I think we've exhausted the forced vaccination issue. And, you know, the funny thing is, I think ultimately you'll agree. Yeah. If all of the conditions are perfectly right, everyone mm-hmm. agrees, by and large. The only question is going to be matter of fact, as is the case in every legal.
And who case. Decides? And who decides? You were right about that.
Just drop my phone. I hope I didn't break it. I just got a new phone. Now, talking about bad economic decisions, it's a perfect segue. We have enough time to broach the question of the day. Bad economic decisions, potentially. Deutsche Bank now jumping on the wagon, saying they're going to cut ties with Donald Trump. We're seeing this political weaponization of financial institutions, financial backing. We've seen it for a while now, from fundraising to GoFundMes to crowdsourcing. Let's start off with the first question. Alan, I guess you'll go first. Did Trump commit an impeachable offense? And what do you make of this, what appears to be a second attempted impeachment?
Well, no, he didn't. He engaged in a bad speech. He should never have given it. I am completely opposed to what he did and what he said. But nobody can dispute the fact that it was constitutionally protected. The leading case is Brandenburg versus Ohio. And Brandenburg, this thug wearing a hood, with people with guns and crosses, a Klansman and a neo-Nazi, said, let's send the ends, and then he used the N-word, back to Africa, the Jews back to Israel. Let's take revenge on the senators, the congressmen. We have hundreds of thousands of people marching on Washington. And the Supreme Court said that was constitutionally protected speech. Compared to that speech and other speeches that have been made on the Capitol by labor leaders, suffragettes, civil rights leaders, President Trump's speech was pablum. So it's, of course, protected. He talked about peaceful, patriotic demonstrations. He shouldn't have done it. He should have known that. And his speech may have been a but-for cause of what went on, but it's not even a close question. You can't impeach a president based on a constitutionally protected speech. And I think what they're doing is playing theater. They know they're going to impeach him. It's easy. You just get a majority vote in the House. You can do that on any basis. And then they won't try him in the Senate because he would have a very good defense in the Senate. So they will either not try him at all, probably, or if they try him, they'll try to try him after he leaves office, which is unconstitutional because the Constitution says you can only remove a person from office. And if you remove him from office, then you can also disqualify him from future service. But you can't impeach somebody just to disqualify him from future service. If you could, they could impeach me. I'm over 35. I'm American born. I can run for president in 2024. And why not hold me in front of the Senate and say, you know, we don't like Dershowitz. We don't want him to be president. Let's impeach him. On January 21st, Donald Trump becomes indistinguishable from me and you. He is an ordinary citizen. And Congress has no jurisdiction over him. So these are simple questions that a lot of Americans disagree with because they just hate Donald Trump so much that they're prepared to compromise the Constitution to get rid of him 5 or 6 days early and prevent him from running again in 2024.
Robert, do you concur with the most of that?
Oh, yeah. All of that. I don't have a problem with the speech. But the in terms of the but-for causation part, what hasn't been fully disclosed is the people who did the raiding were raiding while he was still speaking. So it was a separate group. I'm co-equally concerned with, people who broke the law, committed violence, all there's plenty of statutes to punish them under. Right. I'm concerned about the U.S. attorney talking about reinvigorating sedition laws.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah,
exactly. Because there's an ugly Eugene V. Debs famously prosecuted under that just for giving a speech.
Of course.
We should, criminal sedition laws have an ugly and unfortunate history. I guess, maybe we'll see another Chicago 7 trial, except it'll be the D.C.
I was one of the lawyers in that. And, I spent so much of my young life defending protesters like Jamie Raskin's father and the Chicago 7. I was Bill Kunstler's lawyer on the appeal. And you're absolutely right. Sedition laws, syndicalism laws, to call this terrorism. I got an interesting call from a friend of mine in Israel saying, terrorism? What are they talking about? Let me tell you what terrorism is. It's killing 34 children in a school in Maalot. It's blowing up an airplane. It's coming in the middle of the night and slitting the throat of a whole family of people. That's terrorism. This is thugs. This is a riot. This isn't terrorism. It isn't sedition. It isn't a revolution. This isn't the 1917 in Russia. This isn't the Cuban Revolution. This isn't an insurrection. Stop using those words. Well, you're diminishing the power of those words. Those are important words.
Well,
this was
Alan,
just a riot.
Just yeah. And it's a good point, is it diminishes those words much in the same way some would argue that by attempting a second impeachment, where the first one was arguably not based on a criminal act itself, that they are diminishing impeachment. But and the other word you used, insurrection. Right. I'm noticing, I'm reading in the news as a total outsider, the talking point in all of the media is referring to it as insurrection on Capitol Hill. It's in all the mainstream media. What is, Robert, maybe you'll feel this one. What is an insurrection in law? Does anything in this come anything close to an actual insurrection in law? And what is the effect of using these terms when they might be out of context?
Well, insurrection has a limited legal application. It's not like there's a criminal insurrection statute exactly. There's the Insurrection Act, but that's about complete lawlessness in a particular region for the purposes of the president or others, as the case may be, declaring some degree of National Guard or military involvement. This was, as the professor says, this was classically a riot. This is what a riot looks like, because you have a wide range of actors doing a wide range of different things. Some people just want to be photographed sitting in the speaker's chair. It was a lot less damaging than some of the riots we saw all summer. They didn't burn anything down. They didn't even take the paintings. There was a lot of riotous conduct in the sense of violence towards officers, violence towards property. And there's plenty of federal, we got more than enough federal criminal laws to take care of that specific criminal conduct. We don't need to use it as a pretext for a new Patriot Act, which is what they're talking about. We don't need to use it as to start labeling political dissidents or people who just riot terrorists, because that completely diminishes the meaning of the word. And we have a lot of statutes and other provisions that are designed to deal with actual terrorism. And I don't want to see those suddenly applied to people that in such an expansive way that innocent conduct can be caught up in the middle of it.
I agree with you.
We have the special rules about financing terrorists. Apparently there's a congressman talking about considering any MAGA rally in aid of terrorism. I mean, this is bad, bad, dangerous logic, far more dangerous than even for my friends on the left than Donald Trump ever could be. The reaction is the danger. And especially, they just don't move on and, move to a new transition, try to persuade. If you're going to unify and heal, you don't do it by saying, let's arrest a lot of people, let's deplatform a lot of people, let's make sure people don't have banking, let's reinvigorate sedition laws or any of this.
But look what else they're trying to do. They're trying to disbar. These are 5,000 Harvard and Yale law school students and professors are trying to disbar Senators Hawley and Cruz for speeches they made on the floor of the Senate. Have they not read the speech and debate clause that says that for a speech made on the floor of Congress, they shall not be questioned in any place, That means the Bar Association. I've defended people from being disbarred. I defended a neo-Nazi who was denied admission to the bar. I've defended communists. Back in the day, you had to pass a character committee to be admitted to the bar, which meant if you were Jewish, you didn't get admitted to the bar, or black, or a woman. And the idea that we're now going to disbar lawyers, graduates of Harvard and Yale Law School, because of speeches they made on the floor of the Senate, and deny people jobs because they worked in the Trump administration, or deplatform people. I'll never get another honorary doctorate. I've gotten 15. I'll never get an honorary doctorate. I'll never be invited to speak in another college just because I defended Trump on the floor of the Senate. I have now been deplatformed and canceled by folks like that. Fortunately, I still have access to the media through great shows like this. But other people, younger people, I have some students who worked in the Trump administration who are now calling me terrified. They're not getting their jobs back. They're being blacklisted. And indeed, there are people calling for the creation of a blacklist. Do they not remember red channels, blacklists? I grew up in Jerry McCarthyism. I remember fighting. I hated communists. To me, the communism was the greatest threat. I grew up in the post-Nazi era, so communism for me was the great threat. Hated communists. I defended them. When I was a student body president at Brooklyn College, I stood up for the professors who were being fired. You want to hear an interesting story? The guy who was in charge, who was very active in trying to fire these professors, was a professor of Italian literature named Eugene Scalia, Justice Scalia's father. And I met him in that context. And I was the student body president defending the left and defending the communists. And the president of my college wouldn't write me a recommendation for law school because he thought I was a fellow traveler, hated communists. I was just a liberal civil libertarian who stood up for communists. And when I went to an NAACP demonstration in Washington, he told me that the NAACP was a communist front organization. That's the kind of McCarthyism I grew up with.
But Alan,
it's frightening, because the other thing is, suddenly, I guess we're just going to burn the whole Constitution down, I guess, while we're at it, in the name of a few people sitting in the speaker's chair and causing a riot on the Hill. Expelling House members and senators their role is in objecting to electors. We have this nice constitutional process where you can go to Congress and have your final election contest heard if it's in the presidential context. It's one congressman have been exercising since 1808. And now suddenly we're supposed to kick out the elected representatives of members of the House and the Senate from their respective states or districts.
This is my question from observing it from the outside. On the one hand, I have never fully appreciated that, Chomsky wrote manufacturing consent. I'm now can easily witness manufacturing extremism in that you you have the people who are in the political powers, financial powers, are now making decisions to effectively isolate, to destroy, to incapacitate individuals to live their lives the way they were intended to in a free society. You marginalize these people because of political ideologies, cut off their financial abilities, don't allow them to get jobs, and then you can see what happens. And I can foresee it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. Right. Some people in the comment section are saying, you know, they remember communism. This is, they're implementing the very same tactics for the very same reasons. It's not just a question of democracy and right. coexisting with ideology.
But even democracy, you know, in this petition, it says that a lawyer should be disbarred if he doesn't believe in a democracy and if he doesn't respect the courts. That's exactly what was used against the lawyers who defended communism. When I defended communists, they always said to me, how can you defend communists? They want to take away your liberty. They don't believe in democracy. I said, that's the essence of democracy, defending people who don't believe in democracy. People forget that between the time the United States was established and the time of the War of 1812, I lived right near Brattle Street when I was in Cambridge. And Brattle Street had an earlier name. It was called Tory Row. And a lot of the people who lived on Brattle Street were people who opposed the American Revolution. And even for years after that, they wanted the return of a monarchy. They didn't believe in democracy. By the way, most of the founding fathers didn't believe in democracy. We called it a republic, if you can keep it, not a democracy. Remember, senators were not elected by direct vote. The people of the United States had no right to vote for president. Any state legislature could decide simply to name electors. They didn't even have to give it to the people. So the idea that you can't be opposed to democracy, our First Amendment, fortunately, protects anybody who advocates the end of democracy, advocates the end of voting, advocates the end of suffrage for women. You can advocate slavery. You can advocate putting Jews in concentration camps. You can advocate all of that under our Constitution. You just can't do it. That's why, like, for example, the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, the BDS movement, you can advocate BDS. You just can't practice it because practicing BDS is practicing discrimination based on religion and national origin. But advocacy and practice are completely different under the Constitution. And so few people seem to either understand it or accept it.
Well, and Robert, I'm going to ask you this one because, and Alan, you'll give us your answer as well. Robert, you and I have seen the weaponizing of everything, prosecutorial system, judicial system, political system. You see now they're weaponizing, they as in political and political elites and political interests are now weaponizing the financial system. Deutsche Bank saying they're going to cut off ties with Trump. It's not enough that Joe Biden's going to get sworn in and inaugurated. Now you've got to crush, destroy, and maim your political political adversaries. Is there not something already baked into state or federal law that protects political ideology and discrimination on political ideology the same way as other, there's protection on other individual aspects?
Generally, no. There's a few jurisdictions that have protections, but most do not. Now, I think that's why I'm for cause protection, because that would encapsulate everything. Now, granted, that shifts power from the employer to the employee, but I favor that just as a political matter. If I'm going to make a pick, I'll go with the employee rather than the employer in terms of making the better judgment, better decision that will best protect people's freedom over the long haul. But the now there are some provisions that might be applicable. So, for example, you may have a contract that has a good faith clause in it. And right. So I'll be bringing suit against a major bank that targeted a guy who was one of the major investors in inner city neighborhoods, the number one beneficiary of his, other than the bank, of his 20 years of work. And he's, you know, Jewish guy from Chicago, happened to be a Trump supporter. Once it became known that he was a Trump supporter, the bank began to discriminate against him en masse, even though he'd made the bank tens of millions of dollars, even though the prime beneficiaries of his project were some of the most successful inner city investment projects of anyone in his field in the last 20 years. And now he's being financially punished and they're trying to bankrupt him. And so we're going to bring suit because in that context, he has contracts that they require them to engage in good faith in the way they deal with him. So there may be circumstances like that that are applicable. I'm going to explore whether or not certain, you know, there's a lot of state laws that say you can't fire someone in violation of public policy. They usually limit that. I might try to expand that a bit in the right jurisdiction, try to protect some people that are being targeted for discriminatory purposes. And so we can see, and then as the professor notes, some of these policies and procedures, potentially in the health context, may have racially disparate impacts, may have may discriminate against the disabled for those people who can't wear a mask, for example, for their health reasons, where there's some stores and employers that are not paying attention to the actual details of the mask provisions.
There's another issue that relates to that, and that is both private industry and government now requiring some employees to take diversity training, which is mind control. I mean, as Justice Jackson again said in an opinion, if there's one star in our constitutional constellation, it's that nobody can tell you what to believe, what not to believe. What if you don't believe in diversity? Or what if you believe, as I believe, that diversity is often a phony to eliminate real intellectual diversity and ideological diversity and to create uniformity of views within racial diversity? What if you have that opinion? It's my opinion. And if I went to a diversity training course, I'd flunk. So do I get fired from my job because I have a different opinion on diversity than the mainstream opinion? I think this is an issue that's going to come up.
Oh, it is, because the Realty Association is now making it so they can suspend your license and fine you if you don't have certain critical race theory classes and courses and conduct. It's amazing how much they've infected. It's the old Popular Front 1920s, 1930s sort of communist strategy of infiltrating all institutions that could influence people's perceptions of the world. And it's just being applied on behalf of the wokesters. I mean, my movement at Yale was called Real Diversity because of the lack of socioeconomic diversity present at the time. Who knows what would have happened to me now if I had that movement? I'm sure I would have been tarred and feathered for one reason or the other by kids who come from mostly privileged backgrounds. To quote Henry Louis Gates Jr., going back to affirmative action, if we talked about, if it was a movie in the Ivy League, it wouldn't be straight out of Brooklyn. It'd be straight out of Brookline. And I think, back when.
Well, now it would be straight out of Brooklyn, because Brooklyn is true. Like, yes, Brookline. Nobody can afford to live there. You know, when I grew up in Brooklyn, everybody just wanted to leave. Today, children, grandchildren, they all want to move back to fancy, fancy Brooklyn, which, when I moved back to New York, I wanted to move back to Brooklyn. I was born in Williamsburg. I couldn't afford to buy in Williamsburg. I bought on Sutton Place, which used to be the fanciest neighborhood in New York, at 25% less per square foot than it would have cost me to move to a comparable building in Williamsburg. So let's not talk about Brooklyn anymore in that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I've got to ask, Alan, this is a question that's been on my mind for a while, and I know that a lot of people are asking it as well. You still refer to yourself, I think you say, as a classic Democrat or a liberal Democrat.
I am, yeah.
Okay, some people are going to ask you, you still consider yourself to be a liberal Democrat.
Right.
The Democrat Party these days seems to be getting behind critical race theory.
Right.
The Democrat media machine has been the one that has slandered and lambasted you since defending Trump, thrown you under the bus, excommunicated you, by and large, as has the political party itself.
Right.
Does one have to be a genius to ask why on earth you still consider yourself to be party to the team that is gang beating up on you now and basically trying to destroy the legacy that you have spent 50 years building?
60 years, but okay, we'll give you the 50. So I wrote a book recently called Why I Left. The title was The Case for Liberalism in an Age of Extremism, or Why I Left the Left but Couldn't Join the Right. So let me start with why I'm not a Republican. I support a woman's right to choose. I support gay marriage. I support reasonable gun control, though I do support the Second Amendment. I support as much universal health care as we can get, consistent with quality and the economy. I support fair and equitable taxation. I support separation of church and state. That's the liberal agenda. And the Democratic Party platform generally supports those issues. The Republican Party platform does not. So I remain a Democrat to keep the party in the hands of Joe Biden. I used to say in the hands of Joe Biden, Schumer, and Pelosi, but today I could not associate myself with Schumer and Pelosi, who I think are violating the Constitution. I don't know how long I'll be able to remain a Democrat. I threatened to quit the Democratic Party when they nominated to be the chairman of the party, a man who had long associations with Farrakhan. Now Joe Biden, who I like and support, has nominated to be the assistant attorney general for the Civil Rights Division, a woman named Kristen Clark, who has a long, long history of anti-Semitism, of supporting anti-Semitic speakers, a professor named Martin at Wellesley University, who wrote the infamous book about how Jews started the slave trade and Jews control the world. And she praised him to the sky. I call on Joe Biden, please withdraw her nomination. Do not put as head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department an anti-Semitic bigot who has a long history of this kind of hatred to the Jews. And you know, the Democrats are trying to drive me from the Democratic Party. I'm not easily driven. I'm not yet Ronald Reagan, who said, I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me. The elements of the Democratic Party have left me, but I still see my job, or part of my job, to try to keep the Democratic Party mainstream, to try to marginalize the squad, to try to marginalize others. But the problem is the margins are growing bigger and bigger, and the center is growing smaller and smaller. So it's a work in progress. If I were in Britain, I'd be a member of the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party opposes the death penalty, favors choice, favors gay marriage, but not the Republican Party has been taken over by social conservatives, the Democrats by radical leftists. So I'm homeless. Maybe I'll just become an independent. That's a possibility.
Now, Robert, I know your history a little more, but you are not shy to say that you considered yourself to be Democratic Democrat at one point. At what point did they, if they didn't leave you, at what point did they kick you out? Because, Alan, I'm going to say this. It sounds like the Democrat Party may not have left you, but they certainly kicked you out, and you just may not have noticed it yet.
They're trying. I'm not easy to kick out. I don't leave voluntarily.
But Robert, I mean, you used to be on the left, now on the right. When did it happen? What was the turning point? And where do you see things going now? Are people just going to go further and further to the left and the right? Or are people going to leave and come to a center?
Well, I'm an old school populist, tethered by a deep-seated respect for the rule of law and our Constitution, and with an innate favoring of the underdog just by birth. And consequently have represented, as the professor has, a wide range of people from a wide spectrum. Whenever anybody questions who I'm representing, I remind them that it's a guarantee that you dislike someone I've represented because they dislike each other, having been on the political opposite side so frequently, as the professor's own clients have often been as well. And O.J. Simpson was innocent, by the way, but we'll get to that story another day. I made money betting on that acquittal. That too is another story. But I think our modern world, I mean, when I was new in law school, it was the beginning of what I witnessed of not really believing the rule of law, that law was a means, a tool of power, sort of had these sort of Derrida and Foucault components, that everything was subjective and that what your job and objective was. I mean, my first legal writing class, they kept teaching us, don't write what the project was, write what the law is, as if you're an associate for a partner. But in fact, you were graded based on writing it the way they wanted the law to be. And it was the beginning of witnessing, okay, hold on, something's happening. And then I've witnessed as my generation has come to some degree of judicial power, more and more of them just don't believe in the rule of law. When I can walk into a court and predict how they're going to rule based on their politics or the rest, that's not a good thing. I should be in doubt. I should have some guess. I should, you know, maybe they have a history of where they lean intellectually, but it shouldn't be as predictive as it now is. And it's very unfortunate and sad to see. I still believe, though, in the rule of law, and I believe Americans will bounce back. I mean, at the worst time of the sedition laws of the mid-1790s, came back, we got rid of it in 1800. And when we passed the sedition laws of 1918, we got rid of them in 1920. I thought they were kind of buried, but they've come back like zombies. But I believe that the ordinary person, you know, the old saying that the rights, there's two great schools, neither the church nor the state can ever close, the archives of nature and the rights of man. Our conscience and our reason are still our great power tools against oppression by anybody, anywhere. And I still believe the ordinary person will rely upon those to push back and keep us centered morally and otherwise. But we have some real obstacles up ahead.
Now, Alan, I want to ask this question to you because I think a lot of people have asked it now, is how can you be pro-abortion? I don't know exactly what your position is in the details, but how can you be pro-abortion and also for forced vaccines?
Okay, I'm not pro abortion. I think abortion is a terrible thing. I'm completely pro gay rights and gay marriage. Why? It's nobody's business what people do. It doesn't hurt anybody for two people to get married or for two gay people. There's no interest, no legitimate interest that a third party has. With abortion, there is. I mean, if people honestly believe abortion is murder and that the fetus is a viable human being, whether religiously with a soul, or Nat Hentoff, who was an atheist, was opposed to abortion. I have grave, grave concerns about abortion. I don't know that I would participate myself or with my loved one. I have grave doubts about it. I'm not pro-abortion. My question really is, does a woman have a right to do something that may have the impact of killing something that many people believe is a live human person? And here I go back to Paul's point, who decides? And for me, that decision should be made by the woman. I don't believe in this with the doctors and the rabbis. That's all nonsense. It should be made by the woman herself should make the decision, but she should make a very difficult decision. She's taking a potential human life. It shouldn't be an easy decision to make. So I'm pro-choice. I'm generally not pro-abortion. I do think that it is a question of who makes that very, very difficult decision. I opposed Roe versus Wade when it first came out, which made it clear I would never be appointed to be a judge or any confirming process. I was opposed to Roe versus Wade. I didn't find the right to abortion in the Constitution. I didn't find it in the law. I couldn't rationalize it. I thought abortion is so complicated, nuanced, and difficult an issue that essentially it should be decided by state legislatures. And I think, by the way, if Roe versus Wade hadn't occurred, just like in Ireland and Italy and all the very, very religious Catholic states and South America are now allowing abortion, the United States would have done the same thing, with the possible exception of a few of your states, Paul. Some Baptists might have very strongly opposed abortion. But I think in the end, pro-abortion would have won, or pro-choice would have won in the United States of America. I also think Roe versus Wade helped destroy Rockefeller Republicans and the middle ground Republican Party. Because what happened is, without Roe versus Wade, suburban Republicans whose children might need to get abortions couldn't vote Republican. They were worried that Republicans would take away their children's right to have an abortion. Once it became constitutionalized, it freed them up to vote Republican, and it marginalized the Rockefeller and original Bush Republicans. And look at George H.W. Bush. He turned on a dime. He was pro-choice originally, and right after Roe versus Wade, became anti-choice and pro-life. So I think it, A, hurt the Democrats. It hurt the democratic process. It was not consistent with the Constitution. So somebody like me, who is pro-choice but anti-Roe versus Wade, by the way, I wouldn't overrule Roe versus Wade. I think it's too entrenched in the law. It's become too much part of our legal system and a dependent and reliance on it. But I wouldn't have written Roe versus Wade if I had been a justice back in 1973.
And Robert, actually, now that I think about it, in all of our streams, we've never even broached this question. I don't know your position on this. Do you mind me asking you, Robert? Pro-choice, pro?
I agree. It should have been a state legislature decision. I wasn't in favor. It was another context in which the basis of Roe v. Wade was this, again, deference to the medical institutions and doctors. I mean, that's really what it wasn't protecting women's choice in terms of the reasoning for that argument in Roe v. Wade itself. It became that in time, but it wasn't at the time. And so it's another reason why when judges decide that they're going to be doctors and or defer to doctors in the medical establishment for a very politically, morally controversial question, I don't like them being the decision makers. I prefer that the people be the decision makers.
I'll make a little news here today. So I've never disclosed this before, but I took a walk with Justice Blackmun one day. You know, he was a loyal Harvard Law School graduate. And one day he was in Harvard Yard and he saw me and I saw him and we started talking. We spent a half an hour walking around Harvard Yard. So, of course, one of the first questions that I asked him was Roe versus Wade. And of course, he justified the decision. But he said to me, I think he may have said this to others as well, but I know he said it to me. I remember it as if it was yesterday. He said, two of the things that influenced my decision was I was general counsel. I may have it wrong about general counsel or on the board of the Mayo Clinic. And therefore, he had tremendous admiration for doctors. He really thought the world of doctors. Also, if I'm not mistaken, I have, may have this wrong, too. It's a long time ago, that he had several daughters, more than one daughter. And the fact that he had daughters and had tremendous respect for doctors inclined him. It didn't make him make the decision. He thought it was right on constitutional grounds. But it had an influence on the way he looked at this. Remember, he was put on the court as a conservative. Remember the term when he and Berger were put on the court, they were called the Minnesota Twins. And they broke. And of course, Blackmun wrote the decision, 6-3 decision, Roe versus Wade. It just goes to show that judges are human beings and they are influenced by factors in their life. You talked about Buck versus Bell. Why would Justice Brandeis go along with Buck versus Bell? Because Harvard University was the center of eugenics at the time. And both Holmes and Brandeis had close connections to Harvard, to the intellectual centers of Harvard. And they were very eugenically oriented. Let's improve the race. I didn't mean the white race, but just the race of human beings by eugenics. And so they were sucked in by the pseudoscience of Harvard.
Yeah, nothing scares me more when the folks in black robes start deferring to the folks in white lab coats.
Yeah.
So that's just my general default position on any matter of that area of law.
Now, this is going to be a broader question because the question of abortion goes into it, that we live now in a political climate. We're talking about financial retribution. We're talking about getting fired, doxxed, having, you know, all your life upended because of political affiliation. We have created, in my view, these, I call them artificial litmus tests, because by and large, very few of these litmus test questions will actually have any impact on our interhuman relations on a daily basis. But we've created these black and white dichotomized issues where if you disagree on it, you have to go straight to demonizing the individual. Yeah. I may tend to think that the rhetoric is more heated on the left side from the politicians than on the right side. But it is, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us. How do we walk any of this back? I see it in the media. The media doesn't want to walk it back. They live off the divisiveness. They live off the clicks. CNN saying, you know, the Capitol Hill insurrection day was their highest ratings ever, blah, blah, blah. Politicians don't want to walk it back because, you know, politicians and government is a make-work project. If they actually solve problems, they run themselves out of a job. How do the people themselves, on an interhuman basis, on a daily basis, walk back the rhetoric to unity, where all you see is the exact opposite on a tangential curve in the wrong direction? Robert, Alan, go first.
Walter Cronkite could not get a job on television today because he's too balanced and too centrist. Networks thrive on attracting a small number, a relatively small number of people, but a very large number in absolute terms, to their political ideology. In fact, today there was an article about how President Trump is going to make a fortune when he leaves because he's going to start his own media empire. And all he needs is, if he has 70 million followers or 60 million followers, all he needs is 10% of that to make a fortune as a media guru. But he would have to stick to his ideology. And so, you know, yes, CNN will never change. They'll never have me back on again, because I present a nuanced centrist view. I used to be a frequent guest, but no longer. And for a while, Fox didn't even have me on because I wasn't taking the extreme pro-Trump positions. And people like me, and I suspect like us, generally, the only way we get to have our views expressed is through our own podcast, The Dirt Show, or your podcasts. And thank God for that. That creates its own issues. You know, First Amendment, we can have a whole other show, and I only have a couple more minutes to be on with you. But I don't think we're moving to the center. I do think the election of Joe Biden was a move to the center. I think Joe Biden made a serious mistake when he didn't step in right away and say, no impeachment, no 25th Amendment. I want a peaceful transition. I invite President Trump to come if he doesn't want to come. I understand that. Let's move on. I want my first 100 days to bring us all together, and impeachment is not going to help bring us all together. So I'm not, you know, in Israel, they say the difference between a pessimist and an optimist. A pessimist says, oh, things are so bad, they can't possibly get any worse. An optimist says, yes, they can. So I'm both a pessimist and an optimist. Things can get a lot worse. But I hope that the election of Joe Biden indicates a trend among many Americans, maybe that they've seen enough of the extremism on both sides, and maybe they really would welcome a more centrist approach where liberals and conservatives could talk to each other.
And Robert, I'm going to ask you this. Do you think the election of Joe Biden represents a pull to the center or a push to the left even further?
I think it's an open question. I mean, I think the professor is right that a lot of the people who voted for him wanted that. They wanted less chaos, less controversy, less division. You know, I was obviously on the Trump side of the equation and would have preferred that outcome. And you know, some friends of mine would say that Joe Biden is very sympathetic to the criminal defendants, maybe for other reasons. But putting that aside, I do hope that we begin to have better public engagement. But it is it's going to be an obstacle. We're going to have to go to independent platforms to achieve it and accomplish it. And I think it's probably good for people in the end. And we're going to have to fight back. And in every good battle has a good villain in order to make the hero worthwhile. So in whatever tradition we come from. So that's the reason why I entered law. You know, it'd be sort of boring if everybody was sort of happy and milquetoast. So there's, you know, there's some major rights to defend, some major responsibilities we have as legal advocates, both in the court of public opinion and the courts of law, to make that difference. And I hope to do so. And I hope people remain optimistic and just remember that their own conscience and their own mind is the best resistance to any form of oppression or dehumanization. And if we continue to on that path, we will be continuing on a good path of our ancestors. And ultimately, I agree with Dr. King, over time, things bend toward justice rather than away.
Well, you know, that's because Dr. King was born when he was born. If he had been born in Germany or Italy in the 1910s, I'm not sure he would see justice always bending in that direction. So it also depends on what you mean by the long term. I don't think justice bends. I think we bend it. I think we control justice, and we ought not to leave it to nature to assume that justice will bend. As you can see, I go through quotation books all the time just to try to trash all these famous quotations. Almost none of them survive scrutiny. So let's continue to question everything.
All right. And with that, I say my only last words, and it's not to be the pessimist. It's just to say that everybody is the hero in their own story. And my concern is that everybody on both sides considers themselves to be the hero and considers the other side to be the absolute diabolical villain. And I don't know how the reconciliation ever happens. If it does, and the way things are going, it looks like it's getting more weaponized with what's being done on tech platforms, which we didn't have time to get into, but at a future date. And we should do it again. Alan, Robert, you guys would be game for this.
Hey, I love this. This was great. This was like a seminar, and it's amazing because we could talk to each other. Look, different views, different perspectives, different backgrounds, but we did, I think, come to some common ground, and there are some differences. But I respect your point of view, and there's nothing you said that I would in any way demonize. I think what you've said has been thoughtful and very, very precise, and that people should listen to it. And you might agree with me, you might agree with Paul, you might agree with David, but we can continue the conversation. So, welcome me back, and I'll be here.
You're going to get roasted because it's Robert and not Paul.
I'm sorry. Well, why did I keep saying that?
No, like it because
it's called worse.
It's going to become a meme. So with that said, everybody, I know Alan's got to go. Robert, final word.
No, just say, you know, it's a great opportunity to remind people that, you know, the reasons why we have civic engagement and civic debate is for self-improvement and self-education as much as anything else. And just the process of doing so helps us all be a better society and a better person.
Perfect.
And I apologize for the wrong name. You know, when you're 82 years old, you should have your name in front of your face instead of Barnes Law. It should have had your first name. Then I would have got it right because I do know how to read.
No, but and Alan, I'll tell you one thing. One comment that comes up a lot in the chat. I don't think people appreciated that you're 82 years old. And I don't want to say it's like a left-handed compliment. It's amazing. It's wonderful to have you here. Sharp as a tack. Names. It took me 10 years to remember my wife's family's names, and even now.
But you want to hear something very interesting? I would say half of my emails that attack me for my defense of President Trump's constitutional rights, full half of them call me senile. They say I'm suffering from Alzheimer's. Just today, my expiration date has come and gone. I ought to retire. I'm over the hill. You know, there's such incredible ageism. And what I tend to do is I usually don't respond, but when I do, I say, "Why don't I challenge you to a debate? Let's see who is sharper, your 21-year-old or my 82-year-old." So I extend that challenge to anybody who wants to complain about my age.
My only observation, I've seen it from the internet, the classic faulty reasoning is that when they disagree with the person, they just go after personal insults. I see it with Robert. I see it with me. Same thing with you, Alan. They go for the cheap shot. But that is what makes us.
And it's not only they don't only do it to David and to Robert, but also to Paul. So let's make sure we include him in our conversation. Right.
We're going to agree to do this again at a later date. There will be some other issues. I like the big tech censorship, and we'll see how that develops, because I think there's going to be more of it coming than less.
And it's a complicated issue. It's such a complicated issue because these villains have First Amendment rights, and we have to balance their First Amendment rights with their destroying the First Amendment culture that we live in. And that's so difficult. I end my book on cancel culture by saying cancel culture is a constitutional right. And yet it's a malignant cancer on America. But we always have to recognize that, you know, we have to strike an appropriate balance.
Sounds great. Everybody, thank you all for tuning in. Robert and I will have our stream on Sunday as usual. Check out the Dersh Show, daily stuff on everything that's going on in the news. So if you want your dose of Alan Dershowitz, it is on the Dersh Show on YouTube and as a podcast as well. I'll put the links in the pinned comment. Robert, you can check us out, everybody, on Locals. Where else? I think all three of us now are on Rumble as well. So there's that platform for anybody who wants to break away from YouTube. With that said, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on. Stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. And everybody in the chat, thank you for keeping it. It was a good chat. It was courteous. Enjoy the rest of the week, and we'll talk soon. Alan, stick around. Robert, stick around for 2 seconds. We'll say goodbye. Peace out, everybody.